दाद मिया चासो चियो दागी जिन सो गे पाए सो नाम की रोला फिंशी सोंगे चुपा शो सोंगे चुरन सो जे चो नाम ला चंचु पड़ो दाद मिया चासो चियो दागी जिन सो गे पाए सो नाम की रोला फिंशी सोंगे चुपा शो सोंगे चुरन सो जे चो नाम ला चांचो पड़ो दाकनिया छासो चियो दागी जिन्सो गे पाए सो नाम की चोला फिंशी संगे जो
It gives me great pleasure and honor to introduce to you. First of all, we haven't been introducing anyone because mostly everybody knows everybody. But Professor Jan Willis, she's one of our, not only one of ours, but one of the most senior scholars in America. Everyone has heard of Robert Thurman, but Professor Willis, well, we know how that goes. I first met Jan when I was an undergraduate at UC Santa Cruz. There, she was finishing up her dissertation, and the title
is the Tattvartha chapter of Asanga's Bodhisattva Bhumi.
And
and that means the chapter on reality as viewed by the Bodhisattva coursing in the Mahayana way.
She was in the professor in the religious studies department, which I was a student. As time went on, she received her dissertation, her PhD, and eventually got tenured in the UC system, as well as at Wesleyan, where she's currently a professor. Not only the first African woman to have a chair there, the first woman. Quite a few publications Professor Willis have done. The Diamond Light of the Eastern Dawn on Knowing Reality, Feminine Ground, Enlightened Beings, Life Stories from the Garden, Oral Traditions, Dreaming Me, an African Woman, Spiritual Journey, which is out on the table. I just wanted to introduce you to her because she is a senior scholar and it's very, just really precious to have you here. Thank you.
It is very precious to have all of you here and a very precious opportunity to be here. So I thank you. And I guess I need to say something at first before going on, because I might not get a chance to say it later. One is, I'm not as old as Ralph made me. You know, you can start young. And secondly, I am so proud. I don't mean it any patronizing, condescending way. I am so proud of all of you. It's just been wonderful to meet you. Tika. Well, this morning, Chuyang began with the 100-syllable mantra. Pema Sambhava, the guru, founded his tradition. And this afternoon, since I want to say something about how the Tibetan Vajrayana tradition works, one of the things that I should say is there is in the Tibetan tradition an emphasis placed on lamas. La in its ancient form means life force. Oh. And the ma means mother. So it's the ancient one that gives birth to all things. This is how Tibetans chose to translate the Indian, the Sanskrit term, guru. Guru is an adjective which somehow Western 70s folk got a handle on because it's an adjective that means heavy. That's heavy. And the feminine of the term, just for those who might be interested, is Guruvi or Groovy. I don't know how that happens, but it just did. Now, one of the features of Tibetan Buddhism, I was saying, is that there is emphasis placed upon a lama. It said, without a lama, there's no Buddha. Before the lama, there's no Buddha. That is, we hear from a teacher about the Buddha. And then, fortunately, we practice with a guru, a lama. So, I'd like to take a more general refuge prayer, say a more general refuge prayer. And in this prayer, which all traditions use, there's the Lama, the teacher, or the Buddha. Sangye, which really means Buddha. Dharma is translated in Tibetan as Chu. And the Sangha is called Gindun. So you'll note in this refuge chant, we did it in Pali before. This is the Tibetan. And you'll note in each case the Lama comes first. Lama hai songe lama chode shin lama Yendunte Kongi Jepo Lamai Te Lamai Nam La Kya Su my song, yeah, my Yen Nung Tei.
Somebody will have to keep me on time here. I think we started just a few minutes late. I want to speak to three topics very briefly. But I am a professor. So that could be well-intentioned, you know, like I mean to speak to it briefly. But, Green Tara, one of the explanations that didn't come out and connects with what I want to say right behind me. I want to say that wasn't mentioned was that in the Tibetan tradition, Green Tara is the goddess of fearlessness. She protects from the eight great fears. The fear of drowning, the fear of lions, the fear of snakes. Now, all these things are also, they also correspond, as Tantra does. There are all these correspondences. So, you know, the lion is pride and the snake is lust. But Tara is the goddess who protects from fearlessness. And so some of the women with whom I work in a prison, the soul prison in Connecticut, take great solace in Green Tara. One of the things she protects from is fear of imprisonment. Now, to my subject, three subjects briefly. One is the Buddhist concern with peace and nonviolence. And I'm hoping I'm going to be able to end with the idea or with a statement to about the fact that one can choose peace and still not be passive. And I've met a lot of people here in the last few days for whom that is the case, and I want to continue to encourage that. Secondly, somewhere in there, I want to tell you something about myself. It's also part of the Tibetan tradition that you be introduced to who is talking to you. Oh, this is a habit I have. If I'm talking about a Sanskrit subject, I say tikaha all the time, which just means okie dokie in Hindi. But if I'm speaking about Tibetan subjects, I usually say oh. So your pardon up front. Hatred is never appeased by hatred. Hatred is only appeased by love. This is an eternal law. The term for eternal law is dharma. Hatred is never appeased by hatred. Hatred is only appeased by love. This is an eternal law. So it is very foundational within Buddhism to choose the path of peace and nonviolence. For some of us, that has been, will be a tough choice. As some of you know, I was raised in what is called the Jim Crow South. We could call it a lot of other things, but the Jim Crow South, that era in the 1950s and 60s. And a lot of what the rest of the world didn't know until 1963, when there was a bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church, a lot of people who weren't in the South didn't know that for more than a decade, a couple of decades at least, there had been an all-out attack against the children, black children. It was very common for children to come up missing, for children to be lynched, for children to be drowned, for children to have acid put into their eyes. So I was raised in a little mining camp outside of Birmingham during these times. There was one street that separated whites from blacks. My father worked in the steel mill, so he didn't work. He wasn't dependent upon the mine. He kept his job. The mine closed soon after I was there. We moved there when I was 2. By the time I was 5, that mine had closed. And men sat on their porches, jobless, hollow-eyed, despairing. But there were still attacks against black children, and perhaps there were more so. You know, you get a depressed area, then it really gets heated up. Okay. So in 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. decided that the children should be in the forefront of the campaign in the city he called the most segregated city in the South. And all us children were ready, more than ready. The campaign began in the spring. Dr. King was arrested shortly thereafterwards. He wrote a letter from a Birmingham jail. Bull Connor was the police commissioner, and after he arrested King, perhaps for King's safety, he gave orders to his policemen to attack the kids, the children. We were attacked with water hoses and those dogs. So I grew up being very afraid of dogs. It was nice to be able to get my own dog and know you could have that special relationship with a dog. Well, in 1965, I won scholarships. Thank you so much. I won several scholarships, and because I lived in this camp, news spread about it, and it wasn't liked. And as a consequence, KKK, one of Alabama's chief leaders, lived in Dosina. We called him the Grand Rooster, but you know, other people called him the Grand Wizard. So there was a cross burning in front of my house. And my father was working a graveyard shift, so he was away from home. My father remembers the day he began working. The day and the date and the day he stopped. He kept his job because he had to keep food on the table. At any rate, KKK came. My father was working graveyard shift. And only my mom was home. And my sister Sandy, a year and a half older than I. And my mom had a .22 caliber pistol. And it was the day when, it was the time when Klansmen were also throwing bombs. I've skipped 63, you know. What I wanted to say was in 63 we marched, but there were people who weren't satisfied with the negotiations that the city reached with the children. So in September of that same year, there's a connection there, the church was bombed. That's the context. So 65, I got all these scholarships. And the KKK found out about it. And so they targeted my family. Now, we had seen people in the black community be targeted before. Everybody knew when it was happening. Everybody knew when the cars went through the camp honking that some black was being targeted by the Klan. We just didn't know who it was. So it was not very good to be conspicuous in that camp. So my mom by the door with her .22 caliber pistol telling us, whispering to us to get down, get under the bed. My sister was trying her best to do that. And I was glued to the window looking out, awestruck. I mean, that the awe, terrific awe. And also just amazed, because what I saw out of the window was that there were more than just men in robes. There were men, women, and children in robes. And I noticed the robes weren't just white. They had purple satin, you know, and stripes. You know, the pomp and circumstance of regalia at a graduation, you know, but it ain't right. Purple satin and red satin. And there were children involved. So my mom's trying to tell me to get down. We're expecting that they're going to throw a bomb. They set up a cross. They do mumbo jumbo, and it's blazing there. And no blacks, all the blacks know, okay, it's us being targeted. But nobody had the courage to help out. It was those days. Later on, blacks started shooting through their doors. They just shoot through the doors. Klansmen came on the porch, they just shoot through the doors. But in those days, people just peeked through their windows and hoped for the best. So my mom was really brave, and I have that image of a strong woman. But when I saw the family there, when I saw the families there, my inclination was to go and to tell these people they were making a mistake. That we were a family just like they were. That we were a mommy and a daddy and two sisters, you know. We were a family. We were human beings just like they were. But I didn't, you know. I probably couldn't have, though that's what I really wanted to do. And fortunately, for all of us, no bomb was tossed. And in several cars and trucks, after a while of ceremony and ritual, bands of people got back in their cars and men, women, and children drove off. The whole idea was, this is a message about your place. And it was important that you not step out of line. So today when I go back down south to county courthouses, I'm doing working on family history. I was before I did this book. I'm gonna finish it up this year in the Netherlands. Whenever I walk into a county courthouse and ask simply one question, hello, could you tell me where the records room is? In 22, if not 25, county probate offices in Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina, I've been met with one response, and one response only. And that response is, where are you from? And it always means, where the heck did you go to learn that you don't look me in the eye and ask me a direct question like that? Okay. I went off to Cornell, and I mentioned in our introductions the other night that I couldn't eat at any lunch counters. Right up through Scranton, this is 1965. Okay. 1967, 68, I went to India. I met the Tibetans. Boy. And that was wonderful. In 1969, I returned to Cornell, and there was a cross burning on the lawn of a place where 12 black women lived. That's why we took over the street. That's why we took over Street Hall. The student union. The administration was terrified. Student union had the radio station. They estimated it had about 6 months' worth of food. It had the hotel. It was Parents' Weekend. How rude of us to wake up those parents and say, could you kindly leave? We're taking over this building. The president was saying the whole time, there will be no police on campus. There will be no soldiers on campus. But we had the radio station and we had his phone line monitored and we played it on the intercom. So we were listening to him talk to the Elmira National Guard. And we knew when he gave the order to come in. That was the time we decided, prudently, to come out. Because the tanks were rolling toward us, and a week before that at Voorhees, they had come and turned there. At any rate, this is long-winded, I'm sorry. So in 1969, they had the cross burning there. I was the only woman of 8 African-Americans who were on campus. Campus, 14,500 people. 8 African Americans, 250 Africans. We didn't talk to one another. So I was the only woman. There were 7 other guys from all around the South, from little towns. And I was made Minister of Women's Defense. You know? 3 years earlier, I'd gotten tapped. Hey, you write the Constitution for the BSA. You can write. Write it, Dan. You can do that. So now, I've helped get guns in the building, you know. And so I'm Minister of Women's Safety. Well, please. Well, I had to learn how to shoot a weapon. And I got my afro had it since then. And all this stuff, you know, go in and pick up this outside person and this outside person. And didn't take care of all the women. Now, what did take care of them mean? Lord, after I won that job, I didn't want it. I didn't want that job. Because campus was a dangerous place then. We stayed together there. When I went there, there were 8 African Americans. When I came back from my junior year in India, there were 260 African Americans, most of them from New York City. Things had changed. So, one of the people who flew in belonged to the Black Panther Party because I had a title, I think. I was told about this guy I was supposed to come see. Another day in Oakland, I talked to a person who knew him well. Just by his initials, I was supposed to go out and join. So the summer of 1969, we took over the building in April. The president wanted us to leave, but we said, no. Thank you, we'll stay and graduate. That was the day of the fist. Thank you. Who was that who said that? Thank you, Russell. It was nice. Of course, the president's jaw dropped when we found the beginning of the line and went through like that. So I had the choice. Will it be the Black Panther Party or returning to Nepal to study in a Buddhist monastery? That was the choice. It was a hard choice. By that time, I said that this race thing just isn't going to go away. And it seemed as though nonviolence, wasn't working either. So I had to consider it seriously. And I did, in fact, make the trip across country with the aim of meeting that person with the initials in Oakland. But when I got there, the closer I got, and this was like, can you imagine sleepless nights? You know how your mind, anytime your mind turns around, me, you're miserable. I was so scared and so miserable and so responsible and so young. The closer I got to Oakland, the more frightened I got and the less sleep I got, until finally, one morning, I said, I just can't be Huey. Raton chair, no, I can't stand on those steps with that shotgun. I just can't do it. It is not me. It is not me. Once I could say that, I slept for the first time in months. And I called up that professor at Cornell who'd said, that's quite a choice you got there. Ain't the body of Nepal. Said, we'll give you a fellowship to go off to Nepal. And I'm so glad I did. On the way across country, I met Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton said, hey, sis, heard you know how to use a piece. I didn't want to have to demonstrate it. I was scared to death to use one, but I was proud as anything. Fred said that, shook my hand, and my fro by then was, you know, here. And when I came into the hall, people parted ways. You know, all these white students. Oh, come on, sit by us. Sit here, you can sit here. Said, hey, they thought I was already a Panther. I loved it. By the time I got to India, Fred Hampton had been shot up in a Chicago flat. Fred Hampton was a fine human being. 19 when I saw him. Fine. Tika high. So, that's all by way of saying that I have certain beliefs, now that you know some of my life. Still hope you buy the book. And write the editor and say, I like the first subtitle. Not this one, the first one. At any rate. All this is to say, one, I believe that the political is personal, but the personal is political also. I believe that peace and nonviolence are the only sane choices we have. Martin Luther King said, we'll learn to live together, we'll destroy it. We'll destroy everything. I believe, like A.J. Mustey, Dutch pacifist, communist, all sorts of things about A.J., but he was the pacifist, one of them of our time. And I think it's because I follow the Tibetan way that I go for this. A.J. Mustey is the guy who said, there is no path to peace. Peace is itself the path. Okay. Now, we can get the Tibetan stuff. I believe that Buddhism, finally, offers methods that are helpful for transforming rage, anger, wounds of low self-esteem, and so forth. That's what I want to talk about. Generally, theoretically, this is how Vajrayana works. And a lot has to do with the teacher whom I met, Lama Tsupten Yeshe. I met him in 69. Everything up until that point had been a battle, a sort of struggle. My private struggle to sort of be smart, to read against all the powers that told me not to. In spite of it, it was my secret. And everything told me, not only Klan, but everything told me there's only so far a black girl can go, and there's only so far she should want to go. Now, there are people here I know who know this story. Okay, but everything, you know, color, you know, just blacks, you know, blacks and the color thing. We got this color thing. Oh, your daddy must have been white. Okay, what can you do if somebody says that to you? As Choyen said, you weren't there. Now, that's not quite what I meant. But I knew both my parents were black, see? But, you know, how do you defend against that when it's stated as an accusation? Your origins are called into question. Now, moving on quickly. Even this gap between my teeth. People said, you know what those gaps mean? Girl, you a lie. You a liar. All I wanted to do was tell the truth. All my life I wanted to tell the truth. I had this gap between my teeth and said, you're a liar, you know. That showed you tell tales. Little Miss Nina Pie, you tell tales. When I met Lama Yeshe, even physically, you know, it was the first time I saw somebody smile, this big grin, this big gap between your teeth. I said, he doesn't lie. You know, like everything about it made it that he was for me. Just what I needed, you know. But now this is what he said about theory of Tantra. Man, even the gap was all right. Doggone. I was 21 before I knew that gap was okay. This is from Lama Yeshe's Intro to Tantra. Something about Lama Yeshe that made him, before he'd ever come to the States, very keenly aware of our temperament. People he had met passing through. He said the one problem he saw in all his students was low self-esteem. So these people could use the Tantra. Why? Tantra offers methods like this. One of the essential practices at all, this is Lama Yeshe, at all levels of Tantra is to dissolve our ordinary conceptions of ourselves, and then from the empty space into which these concepts have disappeared, arise in the glorious light body of a deity, a manifestation of the essential clarity of our deepest being. The more we train to see ourselves as such a deity, the less bound we feel by life's ordinary disappointments and frustrations. This divine self-visualization empowers us to take control of our life and to create for ourselves a pure environment in which our deepest nature can be expressed. It is a simple truth that if we identify ourselves as being fundamentally pure, strong, and capable, we will actually develop these qualities. But if we continue to think of ourselves as dull and foolish, that is what we will become. The health of the body and of the mind is primarily a question of our self-image. Those people who think badly of themselves for whatever reason become and then remain miserable, while those who can recognize and draw on their inner resources can overcome even the most difficult situations. So how does the Vajrayana work? Very simply, it works this way. Now, Choyan has told us about Nimapa. And he didn't...
Yeah.
It was very good. He didn't give away too many of the secrets. Well, that was good. We didn't talk about the natural state of mind. And the Gelupa that I'm... I come out of the Gelupa tradition, Lama Yeshe does and Dalai Lama does and all. That means the virtuous ones. It's a reform sect which says you can't skip ahead to tantric practice. You have to do Theravadin practice, Mahayana practice before tantra. So Tsongkhapa put on the yellow hat to identify himself with the original saffron-robed Indian monks, Tikaha. See how quickly that happens? Went to India, so I said, Tikaha, okay. At any rate, there are these principles. They can be said briefly. The Vajrayana uses the end as the means. It says, we know you're already a Buddha. Well, doggone it, be a Buddha. Yeah, it is. That's the secret of the method. It takes the end as the means. So you melt us down, beam me down, Scotty. And in its place, using your visualization, you create. It's not simple. You create an arcane internal yogic system. You're doing lots of yoga. It's really kind of technical. But basically, what you're doing is transforming your ordinary body, speech, and mind into a Buddha's. And this means from the beginning, contemplating, thinking, viewing, as though you were a Buddha. Oh. So the danger of it is without a lama, without a guru, you just dig the hole so much deeper of samsara, your arrogance grows by leaps and bounds. You think you are somebody. But instead of getting liberated from samsara, you get deeper and deeper into it. Well, Kala Rinpoche said in 1974 in a church in Newman Hall, and I'll never forget it. Good piece of advice. Kala Rinpoche said, the aim of tantric practice is for us to be authentically ourselves. And you've heard that a lot. You heard that from Angel. Buddha nature. Be authentically yourself. So what Kala Rinpoche said, don't swap one pretense for another. That's not Buddhism. Buddhism is about becoming authentically yourself. And your authentic self is already Buddha. It's already capable. It's already compassionate. It's already... Now, the deities come in like this. There's about 740 deities in the pantheon. And for meditators, and I have to say, the Western tradition makes such a sharp distinction. We all grab for the, we want to be meditators. 308 Buddhists, 308 million Buddhists in the world, 306 million, 6.5 million of those practice the devotional form of Buddhism. Not to sit on the cushion Buddhism. To offer incense, to offer flowers, offer Buddha, make prayer to the Buddha. They practice that. In the West, we want to sit on the cushion, get to wisdom, and talk about shunyata and voidness and all that. So Kala Rinpoche's teaching is very important here because imagine you get proud. Hey, yesterday I was just ordinary old me. Today, I'm a Buddha. Get out of my way, girl. I'm powerful here. But duh. And that's how it is. That's ludicrous, you know. You're not hardly a Buddha. So that's why you need a lama. Because it's really easy to fall off this path. That little ego just jump in there and say, hey, you grand, you fine, looking good. You don't have to turn green. Anyway. The deities are used like specific medication. You want to improve your memory? I think you need to hang out in the form of Manjushri for a little while. You want to improve your health? Well, I think you need to hang out in this form, White Tara. Okay. But all the time you're doing that, you are not swapping one pretense for another. You have to know that this is actually you. The deities are not external. None of those deities are external. But deities are iconographic representations of our innermost selves. So Green Tara is fearless, long life, courageous, all those things. When you want to feel that way, and what Lawrence was saying the other day about those wrathful deities in Tibetan Buddhism, if I may give up this little secret, those wrathful deities, you know, they're benign deities like the Taras, and then they're wrathful Taras, you see, and then they're benign, and then there's this mid, sort of semi-wrathful deities. They have fangs, but every other way. Well, they look like deities, so I can't say they look like human beings. Well, but they have fangs, semi-wrathful. And then there's these wrathful ones. And the wrathful ones are about feeling capable. It's that surge of power. Tika. Use the end as a means. The meaning of the deities, it's called a speedy path. There's nothing else for us to do that's outside. It's a little, well, it's more than a little technical, the internal yogas, but they're for particular temperaments. They are also for desperate people, it is said. I want to become a Buddha right now so I can help, not so I can say, go girl, I'm a Buddha. Tika. Anything else about what we are? I don't think so. What I want to suggest is just that we talk about the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There is a cause of suffering. There is a cessation of suffering. There is a path leading to the cessation of suffering. The 84,000, the so-called 84,000 different methods offered by the Buddha manifest in that last truth. There is a path. There are different methods for attaining Buddhahood. There are different methods. Different cultures have developed different ones. If you think the Tantra might appeal to you, oh, I left out something important about Tantra. It's often misunderstood. I don't know, Chuyen, I hope you'll let me get by with this. It's often misunderstood. Seems some people, you know, have you ever had anybody go on Tantra retreat and it was about, you know, better sex? They have those, huh? Yeah. Okay. Imagine the English arriving in Tibet and going into these temples, 1904, you know, there's a lot going on. England's trying to get in there to block Russia, to block Soviet Union, to block China, blah, blah, blah. But they go in, they're horrified because there are these, as Shreya mentioned, or as, sorry, as Galen mentioned, they're deities in union one with the other. We ought to also say on most of the traditional paintings, the feminine is smaller than the male, even though they're together. He's facing out, and she's usually facing in, and she's smaller than him, so we need some new artists out there, but she is wisdom, he is compassion. He is active compassion, she is wisdom. Same side, you know, different side, same coin. Because wisdom is nothing if it's not put into action. The moment it is put into action, it's compassion. So, in the Tibetan tradition, those images gave people the idea that there was some hanky-panky going on here. Especially those Catholic missionaries, they said, these people, they got Catholicism, but they got it all mixed up. It's just a total distortion. You know, they saw the robes, they saw the incense, they saw the... It's a total distortion. And some of those early scholars, like Austin Waddell, they said, you know, it's the most horrific, distorted, perverse, heathen religion. Taken our good Christianity and turned it all around. Anyway, that was Waddell's problem. But I know I'm going on too long. Am I going to make a point here? I'm going to get to a point. I'm okay? So, that on this most important point, the last thing that the Tantra does that makes it appealing to certain people, when I say it's good for people with certain temperaments, there are sex involved sometimes. Sometimes. Not always. But the flavor of Tantra is this. It says rather than, I think some tantricas have Theravadins wrong. Can we talk? They say, oh, those Theravadins, they spend their time sublimating, pressing down, greed, hatred, delusion. Starts to rise, and they go, desire starts to rise, they go, you know, everybody harbors prejudices, so. Some tantric masters, they say, well, I don't know about those people practicing Zen. They could be sleeping. Come on, Zen folk, you can come back with it. Come on, we ready. But practicing Tantra is not about having sex. I gotta say it. But it is about using the energy of desire, using the energy of anger, using the energy. It's about using the energies of those things. It says, since we do it all the time, we visualize ourselves negatively. Hey, visualize yourself positively. You know how to visualize. You're doing it all the time. You're doing it anyway. Might as well make it positive. Okay, so substitute this deity, visualize yourself strong, capable, fearless. It becomes a habit. It actually takes after a while. Okay. The other thing is, you always feel with desire. Or you feel with anger, or you feel with something. It's got energies with it. Now it takes some practice to separate the energy from that negative emotion. That's the discrimination that Tantra asks us to make. The distinction is between that negative emotion and the energy of that negative emotion. Okay? That's a little tricky. Again, a reason why you can fall deeper into samsara rather than get liberated. So it takes guidance. But those are the main features of how the Tantra is a practice. Takes the end as the means, uses visualization, of deities specifically for specific illnesses, works on transforming ordinary body, speech, and mind to Buddha's body, speech, and mind through this process of visualization, and uses the energy ever present of negative emotions and uses them to propel us along the path. So, Dika. There might be questions. So I'll just go to the second part. In the 8th century, Sanskrit Mahayana scholar named, poet, scholar too, but poet, Shantideva, great Shantideva, Bodhicharya avatar, entering upon the course of Bodhisattva, written in verse. I read the Dhammapada verse, right? Dhammapada verse, hatred is never appeased by hatred. Hatred is only appeased by love. This is an eternal law. That's verse 5 of 423 verses of the Dhammapada, an early text written in Pali, meant for the laity. In the 8th century, Shantideva writes, Bodhicharya Avatara in verse form, in which he says, a couple of verses, one's mind finds no peace, neither enjoys pleasure or delight, nor goes to sleep, nor feels secure, while the dart of hatred is stuck in the heart. In Buddhism, hatred and anger and aversion and greed, desire, these emotions are called kleshas, from klish, which means to destroy. So these are negative emotions which harm. Has anybody been angry? Really angry here? Well, I know some have. They had good counseling. All right. Was it a fun experience? It wasn't fun for you, right? So these are called afflictive emotions. I mean, one time I was angry for like a couple of days. It was miserable. It was terrible. I have to destroy the world. I just have to destroy everything. Of course, I had to just know I wasn't that big. Couldn't destroy the world. But I thought, if all this rage came up, then everything would be wiped out. But it was a miserable feeling to be hot and sweaty and not be able to your mind just can't settle. Me. Poor me. Now, Shantideva again. There is no evil equal to hatred, and no spiritual practice equal to forbearance. Therefore, one ought to develop forbearance by various means with great effort. Alice told us about forgiveness and what it does for us in allowing us to turn away from the oppressor, to turn inward. Forgiveness helps us forget about what it does to others. It'll probably help them too, but it helps us. It helps us to heal ourselves. Now I want to take a shift just for the last couple of minutes and say, I think Buddhism in its various forms and traditions and lineages offers methods that can be fairly easily, I get in trouble for this. Well, don't tamper with the lineage. Don't tamper with that lineage, Jan. That goes all the way back to Siddhartha Gautama. Don't mess with it. Well, you know, I was a philologist first, so I like the meanings of words, you know. Cute means so many things. The word that Trillian talked about, tantra. Cute, it means so many things, you know. But I want to be like Wittgenstein. You know, Lawrence didn't like that. And say the meaning of a word is function in language. Whew. So lineage, what is lineage there for? It's there to inspire us, right? I think we can put more in that lineage. More people inspire us. You know, all the doggone ancestors back there, Lawrence, that was so beautiful. Ah! They can go in our lineage. Far as I'm concerned. Now run and tell that. It's a lineage of inspiration. Troyan knows this. But some people give me trouble about that. Kind of going far. Now, the other thing is, just as I said earlier that the deities are but representations of what's inside of us, it's a method, it's just a method, you know? And after you use the method, you don't need it anymore. You don't need to say, I'm green tired. You know? You're just out there being courageous. Go for it. Okay. So I think there are ways to talk about that as a method. You know, like to get at what the method is, you know, because we weren't born looking at deities with thousands of arms. I mean, that may be attractive to some of us. And, you know, we can think about the meanings and we can say all this, you know, this means he's capable of doing this, 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 this. Wherever beings need him, he can serve because he has this weapon and this thing and this thing and this thing in his hands. But it just means really capable. We can say that without going there to Tibet, I think. I don't want to do away with it at all, but I just want to say that when the women in that prison got this meditation, it was actually on Green Tara. The next session we had with them, apparently all sorts of people had said, no girl, green. Something that's green that can't be helpful to you. Goddess or no, if it's green, you don't want it. So then we just talk more about what the goddess represents, you know. Talk about fearlessness, you know. So I wanted to do that. So one of the things that I've been engaged in is working with my partner to put together a series of practical exercises that grow from the Vajrayana tradition and grow from the Dutch women's health movement. And the book is, I thank Dala for mentioning it. It was called Transforming Prejudice, and that's what's written in the blurb about this event. But we've changed the name. It's called Ending Hate, Practical Exercises for Groups and Individuals. And we're hoping we can find a publisher soon for that, because it seems to work or to be helpful in some cases. Now, last thing I want to say is Shanti Deva's verse Shanti Deva's verse, there is no evil equal to hatred and no spiritual practice equal to forbearance. Therefore, one ought to develop forbearance, patience, you know, all by various means with great effort. I just want to say that choosing peace, which I think most of us have, does not mean being passive. Pacifism does not mean being passive. Compassion is active compassion. It's always active. Anything that takes you out of yourself, that lessens your clinging to self, when you give over to others, when are you happiest? When you volunteer at the soup kitchen, when you give over self, the action looks compassionate, and what you gain is wisdom because you lessen clinging to self. So they work together, you know, male and female deities, masculine and feminine qualities within ourselves. So this forbearance that Shantideva calls for, and I should tell you that at the end of Bodhicharya Avatar, he really berates certain negative qualities, and then you find out he's been talking to himself the whole time. It's sweet. It's really sweet. Read the Bodhicharya Avatar if you get a chance. So I think I just want to say that the idea that being pacifist doesn't mean being passive. And I would like to, I think, end it there. I know that lots of you in the audience are doing great work. I wish to encourage you to continue to do that work. There's nothing that says our great Buddhist retreat should end at the gate on our way out. And I think your active compassion already should be recognized. So I want to say Ashe to you. Thank you so much.
Questions?
Are there any questions? I think I might be able to help. Yes. I think a lot of Buddhist groups are getting involved with prison work, you know, the last few years. A lot of Buddhist groups. A lot of other kinds of groups, not just Buddhist groups. The thing that I never had before was an invitation, you know, an entree into the prison. Well, I don't know. okay, I think back on it, trying to tell the truth too much. Just go to the point. You know when Angela Davis was in the House of Detention in New York City? Mm-hmm. Anybody know how that House of D looked? That old castle, that turret? Green slime, rats. Okay. I was a Columbia grad student, man. So I did work in prisons before. But it was the kind of thing where you do a rummage sale, and you go in and you sort of make a connection with one woman and say, put Ralph's name down so Ralph can come visit you, and then Ralph would go to that person and then get another name. And so many times there would be women there who, you know, the kid stole the candy bar and the guy went berserk. And now her kid's somewhere she doesn't know where, but taken by the state, and she's in jail because she doesn't have $50 for bail, right? That kind of thing. So we raised bail money, and we just did a little round. So that was grad school. But I didn't have an entree into this. until a wonderful man by the name of Joe Lea, who is one of 12 teachers at York Correctional Institute, he read a piece that was in the Times by me. We could talk about that story. I thought it was funny. Anyway, it was in the Times, and the day after that piece came out, he called me a spiritual innovator. I said, what the heck is a spiritual innovator? What is that? Do you know? Anyway. A day after that, Joe Lea sent an email asking me to come and read, the book wasn't published then, to come and read from the manuscript of the book to some of his students. Connecticut, as I mentioned, has one state prison. It has no juvenile centers for girls, so that everybody's there together, ages 14 to 72, population of 1,600, 400 in a school, the others work. The one work is making meals for the other five men's prisons in Connecticut. 400 get to come to school, though. Joe is one of 12 teachers, two men, 10 women, who teach at York. And Joe invited me to come to York. So I went to York, and he invited me to do a reading. I said, well, you know, we've been working on these workshops, done some at Vajrapani, you know. Got some pictures here of our Vajrapani people, Lawrence and Lewis and, you know, anyway. Had been trying to work on these exercises before. So, okay. So I said to Joe, well, I'd be happy to read, but I'd rather, you know, we could set up something more steady. So Joe worked out with his class and with some of the teachers there at school. We worried about whether that was going to be good or bad. We set up a system of going down weekly for a month at a time, then skipping a month and then going back weekly. And it turned out that having the teachers there was a good thing at the end because, I mean, for one thing, all women are so articulate. Sweet, gentle, articulate. They took the exercises, you know, like food. They weren't like my students, you know, you can take it or leave it, hey. That sounded pretty good today in class. I don't think I'll try it. They took it and they put it to use, you know, so it's really a pleasure, right? I mean, it's heartbreaking, but it's a pleasure because you use it. One woman who's a little younger than me, I have to tell the story. One woman who's a little younger than me, I'll stop. What I do with them, we do visualizations, we do physical exercises, we do bodily things, we do touching toes, we do dances, we do songs. Everything we can do. You know, you break the rules because you're not supposed to touch and you're not supposed to, what's up? We just do, you know, human being to human being stuff. And it makes a real difference. It seems to make it. Certainly, we get a lot out of it. They tell us they get a lot out of it. And we believe them. You know, you have women in a confined space. It is easy to go on up here. I see that. Somebody take this mic away. Sorry. I told you, you know, I'm a prof. Love an audience, love an audience. So we do all sorts of exercises in a workshop setting, you know. We're all sitting on the floor on mats, you know. And most times it goes well. Sometimes a guard comes in who's not too nice. Then, boom, people have to stand up, say their name, say their number. Other times, guards are okay. They just come in and check off. These women also train the dogs, you know, for the blind. And so they have something warm and, well, that's great. But we do all sorts of exercises, you know, with them. And I don't know, do you mean specific or just that's okay? Okay. Yes.
You mentioned going to Nepal on a fellowship. What about someone that may be interested in going to Nepal today? years ago about finding a monastery to study with.
Well, you know, in schools, there are these programs that send people all the time. So it depends on, there are programs that send college folk, right? Work up a network of allies. Go to a center here. If there's someone here that you know who's connected with Pulihari in Nepal, for example. I have students go there all the time, and when they come back, their Tibetan is so incredibly good. These are undergraduates. They go on a program, and then they decide to stay in Pulihari. Think about India and Nepal now, because it's not as open and is dangerous in some places, too. I think use the net, Dharma net, look at this, look at that. Connect with centers, talk to people at those centers. You'll find that people have been to places, they know names, they can give you names, they can maybe hook you up. San Francisco is the best place to get a visa to India. They ask you how many years you wish to be there. Nuts! 3 months from any place else. 3 months. They ask you how many years you wish to travel in India. On the San Francisco alone, the consulate from San Francisco. We can talk more about that. Yeah.
Notion that you're supposed to mind your own business and that what people are doing is right, you know, but it's like when I'm outside or when just whatever, you know, I don't know if it's about me getting involved in cultural education. I don't know if it's about me accepting it because culturally, like, you're not supposed to make this stuff, you know, and it doesn't matter.
Appreciate the question. I think it's possible. I'm not trying to suggest to you that it's easy. I don't think you can just decide to love your neighbor. I don't think you can just decide that. I think that takes real effort. And we've been talking about methods for doing, there are methods out there for doing this. There's a practice, right? But at the beginning, that works as, you know, I'm not going to be angry again. That's one pretense for another. And that works until somebody makes you angry. I mean, it's really easy to smile here, isn't it? It's so wonderful, you know? Because you get a smile back, you know? People are, but that won't happen a few days from now, maybe. And so what do you do?
I think one of the ways of, I think one of the things we should be talking, one of the, sorry, that was heavy, we should be talking about, I didn't mean that. One of the things that might be useful, is that we talk about ways not only to carry some of this good feeling back with us, but that a real general way of talking about what meditation is about is to help us develop some stability, some distance from the problem, even if it's a breath. You know, we had that already. Count to 10. Count to 10 before you do something. You know? And that doesn't have to be Buddhist. But it not only helps us to get grounded, we're getting grounded so we can get clear about how to help. Dalai Lama says that all the time. He says, if you can't, worrying won't help. But if you really look and you're clear, you'll know whether or not you can, and you'll know exactly what to do. And I just want to say, Tupac and Stevie, use your talents. Tupac and Stevie sing about that. Does anybody know the song? I mean, come on, you know, like it was wrong to let this girl have this trouble. Everybody in the community knew it was happening. That ain't right. You know what I'm saying? What is it? Brenda's got a baby. That's one of them. Outlaws. Okay, use your talents. You got them. You either ride with
had to do it.
We don't go there. This is a Buddhist retreat. You either ride with me or collide with me. Good question. I think early on in our paths, we talk about, now this compassion that we're talking about, this is definitely not pity. Pity doesn't help anything. You know, we've probably all heard this. Pity is a hindrance. Pity is not clear-minded. Go do something. Don't just sit there. No, we're till we're born in some place. What's the title? Don't just do something. Sit there. Okay. Well, but I want to go the other way. Anyway. So pity is not compassion, right? There's loving kindness. There's love for someone. Compassion is the wish that all beings be happy. Active compassion is carrying forth with that wish or intention. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.